Good morning, folks. Friday, June 27th. Hope you're having a great day thus far. We've got a wonderful show lined up for you today. We'll visit with J.P. Morrell, New Orleans City Council member. We'll talk about the most recent court ruling by Judge Jennifer Medley, who dealt a blow to the City Council's efforts to restrict the out-of-town travel by Mayor LaToya Cantrell and her administration. We'll talk about that. We'll talk about the Oh Woe Is Me tour that Mayor LaToya Cantrell is on as she visits the U.S. Conference of Mayors and describing the trials and tribulations of being mayor as a black woman, and blames her gender and her race as the reason for all of the issues and problems that she has. Totally forgot about competence and accountability and, you know, connecting the dots, doing the right thing. None of that. It was all about her race and her gender. We'll talk to Will Guillory at the top of the 12 o'clock hour, NBA writer with The Athletic, and we'll sum up the Pelicans' draft choices. We'll talk about those and what they mean. Crystal James joins us, program manager for Common Ground USA. They're putting together a diverse group of folks, and they're going to be talking about conflict resolution and other matters, and dealing with some of our kids and issues that we have throughout the city. The St. Tammany Economic Show, Dr. Will Wainwright, who's the president of the Southeastern Louisiana University and former board member of the St. Tammany Chamber of Commerce, will visit with us to talk about what's going on at Southeastern and the impact that they have on the North Shore as well. Recently, there was an NOPD officer, after a five-year investigation, was released from that organization. Dr. Skip Gallagher, UNO professor and NOPD watchdog, has a few comments to make about that particular case, and we'll visit with him at 10:30. Number of cases coming out of the U.S. Supreme Court today. One of the first this morning that we were made aware of was Trump versus Casa. The justices ruled 6-3. Obviously, along ideological lines, siding with the Trump administration's challenge of these district courts and the implementation of nationwide injunctions. This particular case dealt with birthright citizenship executive order. The court did not weigh in on the legality of the birthright citizenship order itself. It sent it back to the lower courts to deal with this issue as it relates to these nationwide injunctions. Justice Amy Coney Barrett was the majority opinion author, finding that these injunctions exceeded the authority that Congress has given to the federal courts. And the high courts ruled that these lower courts cannot prevent the federal government from enforcing its policies against non-parties to the specific case that's before these district courts that they're ruling on. And that's the impact of these nationwide injunctions. You have parties throughout the country that aren't even part of this litigation. When they issue the nationwide injunction, it imposes itself across the country and limits the rights of others. Of course, it's been argued for years now that it exceeds the rights of district court. Finally, the Supreme Court is beginning to rule and curtail on this expanded authority that district courts have given themselves. A lot of lawfare going on, a lot of judicial activism going on as it relates to these types of injunctions. And hopefully, with this case and several others, I think, that are making their way through the court system at the present time, that will put this issue to rest. It's going to be interesting as it relates to the core issue of birthright citizenship once that starts to make its way through the court. And of course, it will end up in the Supreme Court at some point in time for sure. Another case that was just announced, the Supreme Court affirmed Maryland parents' right to opt their children out of mandatory curriculum that violates their religious beliefs. This was a long, drawn-out battle. The litigants included Muslim, Catholic, and Orthodox parents who objected to the school's sex and gender curricula. This is all coming out of Montgomery County. There has been so much controversy in Montgomery County public schools in trying to cram down the throats of parents this whole notion of this educational realm around LGBTQ issues. And the school had begun to implement, just as a reminder, storybook lessons back in 2022, not as part of its sex education curricula, but part of its English language curricula. In the sex education curricula, the parents had the right to opt their children out. Well, Montgomery County didn't want to allow the parents to opt out as it relates to LGBTQ storybook lessons that discuss same-sex marriage, gender dysphoria, sexually explicit themes, and stuff like that. In fact, in congressional hearings, you had members of Congress actually reading passages out of these books, and it was like pretty incredible, quite frankly, to third graders and second graders and the like. So Montgomery County thought they were going to be cute, and they didn't put it in the sex education curriculum bulletin. They put it in the English language arts curricula. So parents were not allowed to opt their children out of the curriculum, ultimately. Actually, at first, Montgomery County did, and then they reversed and said, no, we're not going to let you do that. You really can't make this up. I mean, you know, so the parents, I think they were really smart in the strategy that they deployed. They didn't ask the court to remove this content altogether. They just asked for the right to exercise on behalf of their children to be able to opt out of it. Because remember, this school district made it mandatory. They made it mandatory. And, you know, typically when you've had instruction on human sexuality in a school, the parent, it was always set up where the parents, the rights were reserved for them to opt out of these. But, you know, Montgomery wanted to go a step further. They were convinced that they were going to be able to pull this off and they were going to win. You know, and so they moved it into the English curricula, and that's where this case lied, and that's how it started, and now it's made its way through, and the court has ruled no. The parents have the right to opt out of this. The school system still says that mandatory instruction in such LGBTQ themes is critical for educating children in a diverse society. It's interesting because they spend little or no time educating on any other issues that are presented in a diverse society each and every day. Of the multitude of religions that, for example, exist within a public school each and every day, the faith, the culture, or little or no time. But the LGBTQ issue, for whatever reason, has been the battle cry for public schools that they were going to draw the line and cram, as one person who was quoted in a number of articles saying, cramming down controversial gender ideology on three-year-olds without their parents' permission is an affront to our nation's traditions, parental rights, and basic human decency. The court must make clear that parents, not the state, should be the ones deciding how and when to introduce their children to sensitive issues about gender and sexuality. It's common sense, right? Why should the ideology of a principal or the ideology of a teacher dictate at what point in time that they would expose these materials to children. And children mature at different rates, right? Who better than the parent to judge the maturity of the children and whether or not they feel like they can handle that information or not? To what end here? It's just kind of interesting that this was the hill that they wanted to die on these particular issues. And they felt so strongly about it. Montgomery County actually spent more than $1 million in legal fees to defend their right to cram this stuff down third graders and other grades on these issues. And a lot of this material is incredibly explicit, right? There's a move afoot across this country right now to restrict access to porn sites on the internet, but we have a whole different thing going on in the school system where they're actually reading porn to kids that are not in the appropriate grade level to hear any of this stuff. But, you know, this, as I said before, this is the hill that we're going to die on. For whatever reason, there's a big asterisk exception when it comes to LGBTQ issues and the erosion of parental rights and them being able to determine what's in the best interest of their kids at certain grade levels or not. Kind of ridiculous, quite frankly. And as you know, I am moderate on this issue. You're happy, I'm happy. Just don't cram it down other people's throats. They don't have to be educated on every little nuance of relationships and how it works in the LGBTQ community. If that's where you find yourself, you're happy, I'm happy for you, as long as you're happy. But don't go trampling on everybody else's rights and deciding for them when their children should be exposed to this materials, when it should be decided to spend time talking about society at large, the diversity of society, things of that nature. That's something that happens at the kitchen table of families. Now, I recognize that in this country, we have a real big problem with the familial unit, right? It's why we suffer on so many different social issues in this country. But the appropriate path is not we're going to overcome that. We're going to cram it down everybody's throat and not give parents the ability to opt out. Very one-dimensional thinking. I mean, it's just kind of confusing to me. That this is the path that we want to go down. So one of the other things that breaking news is that on one of the aspects of the big, beautiful bill, budget bill, is that there are provisions in there that have already passed the House. They're being debated in the Senate at the present time as it relates to an overhaul of the federal student loan system. Senate Republicans say that it could save as much as $300 billion. But the real feature of both plans is about caps being placed on how much money people can borrow from the federal government to finance their education. We know very well that we find a lot of our young adults graduating from school that are completely and totally upside down. They're facing, I was reading and listening to a couple of podcasts yesterday and again last night and this morning on this issue. Horror stories about kids leaving undergrad with $175,000, $185,000, $195,000 in debt. And the job, the degree they got, the job that they got pays $40,000 to $45,000. And they're recognizing that if they want to get married, move on, have children, start to establish an adult life, all the things that we want everybody to do, they are so behind the eight ball as it relates to their student loan, they really can't afford to go borrow any other money in order to maybe buy the house, buy a car, buy the other things that we do, because their degree and the job that they get will not support it. And part of the problem right now is that there's not any real limitations to this. And everybody has leveraged this kind of freewheeling approach to borrowing money. There is no other avenue to borrow money that's even close to how lax it is relative to tuition loans. The vast majority of these folks would never get the loan that they're getting here because their propensity for future earnings would never support it. You couldn't get it. So the thing is that they know that when they're lending this money, they are down and out. They will be struggling. You cannot extinguish this debt through a bankruptcy. They've protected themselves very, very well. And meanwhile, just passing the dollars out. Financing tuition, housing, food. Leaving school so upside down that now they're begging for the loans to be forgiven. Your taxpayer dollars that put this stuff out there for them to borrow, and they don't want to pay it back. I feel very strongly about it. I know you do too. Hey, I can name a million other things I'd rather my tax dollar go to. Sorry for you. I'm not angry with you. I'm not mad at you, but you got to go figure that out. That shouldn't fall on the shoulders of the taxpaying citizens of this country. So what they hope to do under the House plan, parents of undergraduates with the Parent PLUS loan program would be limited to borrowing $50,000 total. And under the Senate plan, they would be limited to borrowing $65,000. Now, there's going to be some type of accommodation and agreement where, you know, it's probably going to fall somewhere between. Currently, no limit. Parents can borrow up to the full cost of attendance, right? And we know that the vast majority of the degrees that they walk out of that school with does not pay enough money for them to support the amount of money that they've been borrowing all along. In 2022, parents in more than 3.7 million families owed over $104 billion through the Federal Parent PLUS Loan Program. By the time a student completes their program, the median Parent PLUS debt burden carried by parents who use the loan is just south of $30,000. After 10 years, more than half of the original balance remains after paying for 10 years. So this legislation also would cap the amount students can borrow for graduate school at a total of $100,000 for master's programs, and a cap of $150,000 under the House plan, $200,000 under the Senate for professional degrees such as law school and or medical school. The detractors are saying that this is going to impact the number of students that can go to the universities. The AMA says that the median cost of attending 4 years of medical school for the class of 2025 is $286,454 for a public institution and $390,848,000 for private schools. Both totals that they talk about would be well above the proposed borrowing caps. And so we'll see where this ends up. But it's an interesting little nuance. It's in the big, beautiful bill of the Republicans trying to address this student loan program that has kind of run amok and have left people in almost really necessitous circumstances when they graduate because they cannot carry this debt burden. It's too much. And, you know, they're paying for 20 or 30 years in order to be able to have any life at all. And the interest number, which is, it's not low interest loans by any stretch of the imagination. They are faced with huge, huge financial burdens. And they're really not, they don't really educate these young kids a whole lot when they're in there signing up for all this. Right. And so it's going to be an issue. We'll keep an eye on it to see where it goes in the big, beautiful bill about that. And we'll report out any other. Just in, the Supreme Court upholds the Texas law that is in place relative to access to pornography of having to affirm or confirm age before you're able to access that. So that's a little snippet of what was just released by the Supreme Court. And there'll probably be more decisions coming down both today, and I think the session ends tomorrow, but I'm not exactly sure. All right, we'll be right back. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and text line. Stay with us. Welcome back, folks. We are joined by Dr. Skip Gallagher, UNO professor and NOPD watchdog. Recently, there was a series of news stories about an officer 5 years after the incident who was under investigation, has been let go from the department. And Skip's here to talk to us about that. Skip, welcome to the show.
Morning. How are you doing this morning?
It seemed like quite a long time for a pretty straightforward investigation, in my mind, to finally get resolved.
Yes. This investigation was started in 2020, and the investigation was completed in March of 21, and we're now in June of 25, and the officer has finally been dismissed. And it's pretty egregious what happened. You basically had an employee who realized there were problems at the crime lab. He was taken out of his apartment, repeatedly told he's not under arrest, but was not allowed to return to his apartment. He was surrounded by three officers so that he could not return to his apartment. He was put in the back of a locked NOPD vehicle, taken to PIB, and there he was forced to resign from his job at the crime lab. It's a shame it's radio because there's about an hour and a half video of this. It is pretty hard to watch. It's pretty hard to watch. I've watched it twice. I get pretty angry. Yeah.
So what was the breakdown? Why so long before they were able to resolve this case?
I think a couple of reasons. One is, if we flash back to that period of time in 2020, PIB was really corrupt. It was basically, the ranking officer there was Sabrina Richardson. There was another officer there. His name was Watson. He often went by the nickname Doc Watson because of his ability to sort of fix PIB reports, either for the good or for the worst. And if you think about that, even this report, once you read it, has so many inconsistencies and is so poorly done. It was a reflection of PIB at the time. Now, it's not the PIB that we have now, thank goodness. There's been real reform. We have a much, much better and competent PIB. And for those who are listening, PIB is the Public Integrity Bureau, which is essentially internal affairs or the police of the police. And this investigation compromised a couple of their officers. One of the officers ordering this to occur was Officer Watson, who ordered this to happen. So they used the excuse of a wellness check to go see if someone was okay, to basically detain them, transport them somewhere, and force them to resign from their job. Now, if you think about who was also involved there, there was another officer on the ground, a Lieutenant Kim Williams, and then the officer that was recently fired, Officer Michael Stalbert. Both these officers were sent to the crime lab as punishment. So in 2020 and before, the crime lab was often used as a place to discipline officers. So if you were misbehaving or you had some issues within the department, rather than maybe being written up again, they would transfer you to the crime lab. There was no practical function there because they didn't have the qualifications to, you know, run DNA or do ballistics or, you know, run drug samples. It was just a punishment. The problem is when you take disciplinary problems and concentrate them in one place, I think what we see is just this, where we have officers.
Yeah, surprise, right?
Yeah, big surprise, right? And some of these names are well known. Now, two of the officers have resigned from the force, retired from the force. Officer Stalwart was fired from the force. There's only one of the officers that was sort of involved in this still left on the force, and that's Sabrina Richardson. So, and there's some really bizarre inconsistencies where in the PIB report itself, it talks about meetings, but these meetings with Captain Richardson and Officer Michael Stalbert occurred during times where they were on detail. How did these meetings happen when they were actually on detail and they're supposed to be in PIB as well? And of course, that goes back to that whole double dipping thing that we've seen where officers were claiming to be at two places at once. And of course, why, you know, Captain Richardson was demoted to Lieutenant Richardson. So, but it's a real bad time in the NOPD. And, you know, getting back to your question, so why did this happen now? There's a change at PIB. There's a change in leadership. We have a chief that I think has a moral compass and is trying to do the right thing. And when you have one of the officers in your department with the longest disciplinary history of any officer, that deserves extra scrutiny. And I think that scrutiny was finally applied. I don't think this would have happened if we had another chief that was internally promoted. I think bringing in an outside chief has really made a big difference here.
Let me ask you, the victim here, Carl Vonderhaar,
yes,
he was interviewed by the media, and he says he believes that a lot of this, relative to this encounter, where for the benefit of the listening audience, two officers showed up at his home without a warrant and basically took him into custody, all the while saying, you're not under arrest, you're not this, you're not that. He says this whole thing was probably an attempt to stop him from articulating other concerns that he had, other issues, shortcuts they were taking, inappropriate behavior, unethical behavior within the crime lab. Do we know whether or not he was ever afforded the opportunity to bring those concerns forward? And do we know whether there was an investigation to look into this?
Oh, my goodness. That's a good question. I had not even thought of that myself. And I know the answer to it, unfortunately. No, the answer is no, this did not happen. And instead, the scrutiny was instead placed on the employee. And, of course, the employee was brought to PIB, Mr. Vonderhaar, and forced to resign from his job because he was voicing legitimate concerns. Now, I think there's some underlying tones here. Often, Officer Stalbert just simply wasn't at work, yet was claiming a huge number of hours. And he was making close to $200,000 a year and appeared to be doing very little. And was this addressed? There was another PIB investigation into that. It was shown that he had significant payroll issues. Matter of fact, I think there were multiple investigations into that, because he just refused to stop. I think in one particular case, he was put on suspension and then got back from suspension and immediately double dipped again. So, which is, you know, you're at work, but you're also at a detail. So you've signed in or both at the same time. So a really, really interesting mess. And the crime lab remained in disarray for years. Luckily, we have a new crime lab leader who's got a significant job in front of her to sort of reorganize the crime lab. And in this particular case, there really shouldn't be any officers in the crime lab. I teach forensic science here at University of New Orleans, and one of the things I talk about in my class is called confirmational bias. By divorcing officers from the science that goes on in the crime lab, you ensure that the results are court-worthy and irrefutable, right? And this has gone, most labs have done this. A great example of this is a Houston crime lab. They used to have a lot of problems, and they went to an all-civilian force, and they have one of the best crime labs in the country now. But it's a lot of work to set this up. As a matter of fact, our new crime lab leader is from the Houston crime lab. So I expect to see reforms that improve the Houston crime lab implemented here.
So I guess it would be safe to say that whatever issues that would have been brought forth by Mr. Vonderhaar probably have been resolved then because of
what... Most of them have been resolved. I understand that there is, when he was there and he was forced to resign, there were no written procedures for how to go about testing, which is just, that makes my head explode. How do you have a methodical process with no written procedures? That has been fixed. And I understand all the drug chemists have been retrained so that they can produce reliable, consistent results. And of course, in a couple of years, we should have a functional DNA lab. You know, but I think that's a whole nother can of worms. So it'd be nice if it was a little sooner.
But yeah, it's interesting, though. Obviously, a lot of this has been cleaned up. I mean, and it's not until years later that we recognize the breadth and depth of the challenge, the problem, the corruption, you know, the incompetence, the ineptitude. Yeah. I mean, I'm not trying to pile on here, but the reality is that every time I have you on, you know, I'm scratching my head saying, my God.
You know, well, let me add one more.
Because most of this is not rocket science, right? I mean, you know, this just runs counter to traditional common sense practices that have been in place in law enforcement for decades.
Absolutely, decades. And look, the NOPD is trying to clean itself up. In the last 3-4 months, they have fired 4 officers. All right, so Officer Stalbert wasn't the only one. Now, it does concern me that Officer Stalbert was just one of the officers that were responsible for this. There should be a serious look at anyone involved in this. And we still have at least one officer involved in this that has not been critically examined. And they should be held to task.
Well, there was a female officer at the house with him, wasn't there?
No, there was. Well, yes, there was. I'm sorry. Yes, Officer Kim Williams. She was, again, she's retired from the force. She had some payroll issues of her own and then sort of quickly retired. But this was a big problem because basically she was the ranking officer at the scene and allowed 2 officers to enter his apartment without permission, without a warrant. And then she was the one that actually locked him in a patrol car and had him brought to PIB. So she has retired from the force. What you can do with that, I don't know, but certainly should have been ushered out. But it's nice that this is being addressed. But
no doubt. I mean, it has to. And a lot of credit given to the new chief and a number of the folks that she put in certain positions, right? She understood that we're going to be challenging, and you know, putting people in the right place is key to changing the culture and the like. And we got to get to a break. I apologize. Thank you so much for joining us. Keep up the great work. We appreciate that as well. Dr. Skip Gallagher, UNO professor and NOPD watchdog. Have a great weekend.
Not a problem, Noel. Bye.
Thank you, sir. We'll be right back. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line. Stay with us. On the text line, it said, did Mr. Vondahar get his job back? No, he didn't go back to the lab. Actually, they are involved in a lawsuit where he's looking for $25,000 in back pay and seeking damages for illegal seizure, false arrest, humiliation, mental anguish in his lawsuit. They're very fortunate that it's not more than just that. I mean, this whole series and sequence of events is crazy, quite frankly. I mean, it's just kind of mind-boggling that this would go on at this point in time. I mean, this was something that you would expect to see in a communist nation, you know, where they're going and grabbing government employees and summoning them and basically arresting them and, for lack of a better term, bringing them down to interview them about what, who knows. I mean, this is an individual that was just talking about shortcuts and stuff that were being done inside the lab that they were going to end up getting in trouble for, you know, and it was like, it's the right thing to do. It's what you encourage your employees to do. Obviously, they did not want any scrutiny within that unit because they were double dipping. They were putting in for hours that they didn't work, it seems, from what we're told, and who knows what else. And just seems like a long time, 5 years, to get to the meat of this investigation and ultimately get to some resolution. Thankfully, they did get to a resolution, and hopefully this will continue in the future because it needs to. Whoever decided that sending, you know, bad employees or problematic employees to the crime lab as a place to rest, I don't know who that person is, but I hope whoever it is no longer with the NOPD. I mean, that is absolutely crazy. It's crazy. I mean, that place has to be sacrosanct all the time, 24/7, every minute of every day. It can't have people that have a problem with doing things the right way and following the rules. Certainly not the crime lab. That's not where you would put them. Right? Doesn't make any sense. We'll be right back, folks. Stay with us. Folks, when we return after the top of the hour news break, we'll visit with Dr. Will Wainwright, the president of Southeastern Louisiana University, and he's also a former board member of the St. Tammany Chamber of Commerce. We check in with St. Tammany every third week or so because they play a very important role to the economy throughout the metropolitan New Orleans area. And we'll talk about the impact that Southeastern has on the North Shore. We'll also visit with Crystal James, program manager with Common Ground USA. They are a nonprofit with deep experience in conflict resolution, and they're kicking off a powerful new project here in New Orleans. So we'll talk about that as well when we return after the top of the hour news break. So stay with us. This is Newell on WWL.